This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Welcome to the Investor Download, the podcast about the themes driving markets and the economy now and in the future. Hello, everyone. Slight change from our usual programming this week. We're going to hear from our friends at The Value Perspective. They're part of the Schroders Podcast Network. In their podcast, they talk to people from all walks of life to understand how they make decisions in uncertain circumstances. It's not just people in finance either. They talk to gamblers, army sergeants, explorers, and rugby referees, to name but a few. And I recommend you check it out. You can get it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This week, however, they do talk to someone from the world of finance. Tom Slater is head of US equities and a decision maker for the long-term global growth strategy at Baillie Gifford. But here's the kicker. While the Value Perspective team focuses on value investing, Tom takes a very different approach to decision making. His team focuses on high growth companies, both in listed equity markets and private companies. Nick Kirridge and Vera German are your hosts for this episode, which explores the fundamental differences between the growth and value styles, but also some surprising overlaps between the two teams' approaches. We'll be back with normal programming next week with an episode on cyber espionage and security. But in the meantime, enjoy.
On today's podcast, we have Tom Slater, who's the co-manager of the Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust and the head of US equities at Baillie Gifford. The foundation of Baillie Gifford's investment process is to identify exponential growth companies with strong competitive advantages and visionary management teams. Tom has previously described his investment style as transformational growth, and even growth at an unreasonable price. And we would love to discuss these issues with him. My name is Nick Kirridge, and I'm co-head of the value team at Schroders, and I'm hosting this podcast together with my colleague, Vera German. Tom, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you here.
Thank you very much for inviting me along.
It would be great if we could start with you giving us a short introduction about yourself.
Sure. So I have worked all my career at Baillie Gifford. I started just under 21 years ago, having studied maths and computer science at university. As is common at the firm, I rotated through a few different teams, working on our Asia Pacific desk as it was then, then UK equities, moving to our long-term global growth strategy at the end of 2008, and then into the US equity team at the end of 2015, I think it was.
It sounds like you've been at Baillie Gifford during a very, very exciting time for a firm that has a long history. I think maybe we'll come on to talk a bit more about that. But if it's all right, we want to start with a little bit around process. I mean, one of the things that was really interesting when Vera and I were having a think about this is we're obviously very different investors, yourself very growth oriented and ourselves very value oriented. But there's a lot of things that we have in common, a lot of our process that's kind of where we have similarities. And a lot of our process is about human nature and about biases and how humans don't really change and taking advantage of that. But we make slightly different inferences here. So as value investors, we're focusing on the fact that people overreact to bad news, which creates the kind of opportunities that value investors go for. Whereas your focus is more on the inability of the average person to gauge how different things could be, how transformational and large growth opportunities could be. So we wanted to start by exploring this topic a little. Why are humans so bad at imagining outsized or different outcomes? Why aren't you? And can you talk us a bit through some examples that kind of bring that to life?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's a huge topic to start with. And I think to start on your point about, you know, the distinction in what we're doing, you know, I think that, you know, the investment industry is sort of polarized around these ideas of growth and value. But for me, you know, there is who wants to buy an overvalued stock? If you have the choice between a company that's growing or not growing, why wouldn't you take the growing one? I think it's used as a shorthand for a lot of different things, but it actually, it obscures the point that really what you're trying to find is underappreciated opportunities. And as I sort of think about this, a lot of my thinking goes back to actually looking at historical data. If you look at the past 30 years in US stock markets, for example, you see this fairly consistent rule over time that about 5% of the companies go up fivefold in any 5-year period. Now that's true of the past 30 years in US stock markets. It's true. The result holds if you look at global stock markets. And so you get this power law distribution of returns. You get this tail of outliers. And so from a process point of view, rather than as many people do, starting with what is the central case for this company over the next 5 years, the way I conceive of it is focusing on what happens if things go right. And that is a way of viewing the world which is quite alien, I think, to many people in investment. Figuring out what might go wrong, figuring out what might trip you up, figuring out how you might lose money, is human nature. And it makes sense in all kinds of settings. But to my mind, the stock market isn't one of them because of this distribution that you can make so much more money in a company if you're right about it than you will lose if you're wrong about it. From a process perspective, start by asking what happens if things go right. How might this company end up on that in that tail of the distribution, those companies that can go up fivefold or more? And why do we think that's more likely than a company picked up random? So you've got to think probabilistically. You've got to think, to my mind, about the upside. You've got to be an optimist to go after these growth opportunities.
I think that's another area in which actually I feel like we share similarities. As a value investor, you're constantly looking at businesses that are blowing up and saying, could things be a bit better? Might I make money here? But at a very different end of the spectrum. And I think that's kind of fascinating, that idea of trying to flip the question the other way around and think a bit about, what happens if it goes right rather than what happens if it goes wrong. And very few people do that because loss aversion is so powerful, I guess.
And I think you almost by definition will tend to sound naive. If you start talking about what might go right for a company, it's much easier to sound smart by picking apart somebody else's argument, telling them why that optimism that they have is wrong. This endless list of things that could go wrong in an investment. And we know that, we can't predict the future. The future is unknowable. Things will go wrong. As we think about the structure of returns, if you are a buy and hold investor, it's the impact of that small number of outlier investments that really drives your investment return over very long periods of time. And so for me, the process is about how do you maximize the chances of finding companies that have that potential? And how do you maximize the chance that you hang on to them for long enough that you actually earn that return for your clients?
Well, perhaps just to pick up on what you just said, how exactly do you go about looking for those transformational growth opportunities? How do you identify them? How can you tell the ones that will end up being those outsized returns from fads? Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, of course. I think part of the starting point here is information sources. If you look at the fund management industry as a whole, so much of the information that flows through our industry comes from this narrow set of sources, a relatively small group of people sitting in London and New York who pump all of the information, and research might be a stretch at times, into the fund management industry. So the starting point for me is that actually with a relatively modest amount of effort, You know, there's a whole world of sources out there that are accessible to you as an investor that might give you a different perspective on things. And then I'd link it directly to time horizon. So if you're, you know, if you turn your portfolio over at 100% and you have 100 stock portfolio, then you need 100 ideas a year. You have to be constantly filtering through that available universe to find ideas that interest you. But if you're going to own a stock for 10 years, then you probably only need a handful of stocks every year to add to the portfolio. So the research process then becomes you can spend time on the areas you think are most exciting. Your shallow broad coverage doesn't matter as much, but identify the areas where you think there is growth potential. Get to know the companies, get to know who the interesting academics are in this area, the bloggers, the opinion formers, and really spend time getting to understand those people, what makes them tick, where you think the opportunities are. And again, bringing it back to this idea about thinking about what happens if this goes right. So that takes you to this point about what is growth at an unreasonable price. Because you're trying to identify these companies that have this potential to deliver amazing growth. But the truth is that most of them won't. And so you know, if you pay up for a company because you think there's that real potential, you know, if it does deliver on that potential, you'd have paid far too little for it. But for the ones that don't, you'd have paid far too much. In whichever direction, the price will be wrong. You just don't know at the start which way it is. So it's not necessarily that we have much greater insight than anybody else in terms of thinking about these companies. But it's much more that you're prepared to accept the risk that goes with them, because you know that if you hit those one or two outlier type companies, it will pay for the inevitable mistakes that you make as you look for those opportunities.
Do you think about that explicitly as you're looking through your portfolio in terms of saying, you know, we only need to have a hit rate of X, and they need to go up the 5 times we think they might, or the 10 times they think they might, to offset, you know, Y percentage worth of stocks that don't do that. And actually, that hit rate's what's important to us almost as much as the returns, to validate whether our process is allowing us to fish in the right areas and to get enough of these kinds of ideas. Are you kind of monitoring that, and how do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's, you know, one interesting aspect of this is if you're trying to buy stocks with a potentially wide range of outcomes, then in your portfolio you want to get a distribution of returns that at least matches that of the index. You know, to get some of the ones that go really right, but in doing so you have to accept that some of the ones that go really wrong. And it's actually if you look at the delivered returns in our portfolios, it's actually really hard to get that full breadth of index outcomes. You know, I think most investors cluster around the sort of median type return. So, you know, yes, it's always great when you pick the stocks that work really well for you. But in fact, you're only likely to be able to do that if you're also getting some of the ones that don't work. So sometimes it's a concern to me that we're getting, you know, are we getting too conservative in some of these companies if you're also not getting the ones that go badly wrong? So, but again, you bring it back to this, you know, the structure of returns. If you set your process up so you're not throwing good money after bad, then there's only 100% downside. But for the ones that you get right, you know, it's not, you know, the really successful ones, it's not the 5 times or the 10 times, but it's the 50 times, you know, that will pay for those inevitable errors that are just an output of the process.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
There are a couple of points that you often talk about with your investment approach, in particular the long-termism, which we've touched on a little bit, but maybe we expand a bit about. And that idea, which kind of goes along with long-termism, I often find, which is the decision to be benchmark agnostic, or, you know, just to think about what's worth more, not what I think will do better than other businesses. Can you talk, we have a view on why we would think that was important, but from your perspective, can you talk about why you think it's important and why you think it's, despite something everybody says, it's something that's really hard to do and you don't see that many managers doing it?
Yes, it's a really interesting topic. And I think it, you know, I tie it back to some of the points we were making before about, you know, why are people bad at imagining outsized outcomes, etc. People's, if you have a lot of people doing the same thing, then as an investor, the worst thing you can do is try to replicate that, because there'll be people that are a lot smarter than you who are doing that. You know, if I want to predict this quarter's earnings or next quarter's earnings, there are lots of people who have either better sources of information than that, or than I do, or are smarter than I am, and I'm not going to win that competition. And so, the same applies, I think, to the benchmark. That so many people start in constructing their portfolio by looking at the benchmark, and I'll add a bit more here and take a little bit away there. That they end up with a portfolio that looks very like the benchmark. It has a high degree of overlap. And as a, when you have that high degree of overlap with a benchmark, you're almost guaranteeing a mediocre outcome for your clients. You know, there's lots of academic work on this that actually shows this really remarkable result, to my mind, that the lower your overlap with a benchmark, or the higher your active share, the more likely it is you will outperform. So forget whether you're making good decisions, forget whether you're making good bets, just the fact that you're making bets at all correlates with better performance. Now, so why might that be? To my mind, it's because sort of goal number one for a fund management business is preservation of your existing book of business. And the easiest way to lose clients is to give them an outcome which is significantly worse than the market. Now, if you deliver around about a market return, you know, a little bit more, a little bit less, but never something that catches the, you know, the eye in a negative way of your clients, then you're much less likely to be fired. And so, you know, I think you get this clustering around the index because people are concerned not about investment risk, but about business risk. I think that, you know, for our approach and the way I think about this is, you know, we're trying to own the best long-term growth businesses that are out there. We don't look at the index. Our starting point is that we will be volatile relative to the index, and we will do nothing to ameliorate that. And we try to be very upfront about that when we're talking to potential investors. This fund is not for you if you're not prepared to accept significant deviation from the benchmark, both positive and negative, you know, in any given year.
This has suddenly made me think about something which is kind of slightly related to this, but a bit of a leap, which is about how you, one, a fund manager behaves differently if they're 50% ahead of the benchmark or if they're 50% behind the benchmark. So we've talked a bit about the ability to deviate from the benchmark and being active and the benefits that can bring. But, you know, I would know from my own experience that perhaps it's very hard to stay consistent, and consistency is the watchword in this job. And no matter how much you try to be unemotional and consistent, it is very hard to behave the same way when you are a long way ahead of the benchmark, the house money effect, than when you're behind. Can you talk a bit about that? I mean, you've been phenomenally successful as a house and as an investor yourself. You know, how are you thinking about that in terms of the behaviors, and as you go into each incremental investment, what that makes you feel about taking risk?
Yeah, and I think this is tied quite closely to this question of process. And does your process reinforce your feelings as an individual, or does it help to ameliorate them? And I think this is squarely in that ballpark, that, you know, it's excruciating personally to lose a lot of money on investment or to be a long way behind the index. And you know, the behavioral investing stuff tells us that we enjoy gains about half as much as we dislike losses. But I would contend that within an institutional fund manager, that ratio is much higher. You know, the number of questions you get about stocks that are going wrong, you know, outnumbers the questions about stocks that are doing well by at least 10 to 1, if not more. And so it's what, you know, how do you set up your process or how do you set up the environment in which you work to try and not reinforce those behavioral demons, but to try and ameliorate them? So we had a colleague, Dave Budzianowski, join the US equity team about 2 years ago. And for him, he's based in the US, but he was spending time in the Edinburgh office and you know, making sure he really understood the culture and the way the team worked. And he said one of the eye-opening experiences for him was that we owned a stock at the time, and it had a profit warning, and it fell by just over 50%. And he said, you know, he saw this news on Bloomberg. You know, it's that sort of sense of, you know, panic about what's going to happen here, you know, what's going to be in the office, and came to, you know, and he came to the desk, and there was no discussion of it. And you know, from the news came out, you know, that it was calm. There was nobody talking about it. There's no, you know, there was nobody asking questions of the analyst who had suggested the stock in the first place. It's part of the culture. It's a very intrinsic part of what we're trying to do. That is, there's no point in reacting at that standpoint. You know, the individual who suggested the stock, you can be sure, is feeling dreadful about it. You know, the worst thing you can do is then fire lots of questions at them. It's just, you know, let's take the time to try and understand what's happened, what's gone wrong, and then think about what we do and get away from that being reactive or reacting in an emotional way to what's happened.
In some respects, that feels a bit like, you know, we're starting to veer onto almost away from process or somewhat into philosophy, but even more into culture. So, you know, what kind of culture do you have? Do you have, you know, a bit of a blame culture or do you have a kind of a respectful challenge culture? And how do you do that? I suppose one of the things that makes, you know, that and I will stop asking questions in a second, but just one other thing that kind of came to mind there was around, you know, yours is a business where in terms of size and scale, it's grown very, very meaningfully over the 20 years that you've been there. You know, how do you, as you're doing that, how do you make sure you retain the ability to have that kind of culture, but also some of the things you've talked about and we think are important within our process and our team too, which is the ability to be radical, yep, to challenge the status quo. How do you retain that as a cozy consensus and, you know, an averaging always develops the bigger you get? I mean, it's just the nature of an entity.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really an interesting topic. And I think, you know, so go back to this one about culture or, you know, what you're trying to do. And I think it goes back to this sort of North Star of we're trying to identify really long-term growth businesses. We accept that that's not easy, and it's in, and you know, even when you found them, the challenge of continuing to own them is really difficult. But what you're trying to do is maximize our chances of doing that. So go back to the example I was talking about. You know, for the worst outcome in that situation, that we've had the profit warning, the shares are down 50%. The worst outcome from that point, to my mind, is that the person who picked that stock does not have the courage to pick the next one. You know, we know not all of their picks will go right. You know, that's the starting point. But you want people to have the courage to put themselves out there. And so that, you know, blame culture or questioning how could you be so stupid, or, you know, I'm going to be taking all sorts of flack from my clients for this, you know, if you go down that path, what you're going to do is you're going to push that person more and more towards being conventional and conservative in their next picks. And so I think it's been purposeful. You know, it's you know, that's not the culture because we're all lovely and friendly and we don't mind if stocks go wrong. But it's, you know, the purpose of behaving in that way is because we think that increases our chances of finding those stocks and hanging on to them. And then I think to your question about, you know, the growth in the firm, you know, one thing where we try very hard at is that we don't think about assets under management. You know, we used to have our work intranet used to have the firm's level of funds under management on it. You know, when you clicked on it every day, you could see what the, and you know, we removed that. And so it's not obvious to anybody sitting in the office at any point, you know, what the firm's funds under management are. And the goal is not to grow funds under management. The goal is to do a really good job for our clients. And then, you know, if you do that well and people want you as a manager, then you'll grow over time. But that follows from actually doing the purpose of the firm, which is to do a good job for clients. And then I think you get into, you know, for Baillie Gifford at least, you know, I think the crux of it is our ownership structure. You know, being a private partnership with people who work their entire careers in the firm. I think that you know, we don't have a short-term profit motive. You know, we don't have a parent that's, you know, demanding that we meet a certain target over any time frame. You know, a lot of people that run the firm have managed money themselves, so they understand you can't outperform every year. So I think all of those aspects feed into the culture and are scale free or they're size agnostic.
I think that's that ownership piece is important, and slightly strange saying that from a big FTSE 100 listed business, but we're one where, you know, as a value team with value having had a very tough period of time, we've certainly benefited from having an ownership structure where a family owns half of our business and has a very, very, you know, has a 200 year history and a very long investment horizon looking forward and has been willing to kind of invest in a star while it's been out of favor. So whilst that's quite different to the partnership structure you have, I think in terms of the stability and the kind of attitude that you have towards a franchise and towards your clients and towards the long term, I can, you know, heartily, heartily endorse that.
I think it's sort of, what is it that, you know, when we're looking at our underlying investments, you know, one of the questions is what is it that facilitates that long-term decision making? And, you know, that founder or family ownership is, you know, is often a really good facilitator of changing the time frame of a business. You know, I guess sort of most obviously in luxury goods, you know, do you want to buy a luxury goods business that's run by a professional management team and owned by institutional shareholders? You know, for me, I would run a mile. It's that family ownership and the time horizon of the people that you're entrusting with your money that allows that opportunity to be exploited patiently. And, you know, not manage for the short run outcome. Anybody can cut sales and marketing and get the profits up, but as for a branded business, that's quite a dangerous game. And as you say,
glory, yeah.
Yeah.
Tom, could we just explore in more detail one of the things you've touched upon? In terms of team dynamics, how are decisions made? Does anyone have a veto power? How do you deal with disagreements?
So I'll talk about the US equity team here, and there are lots of ways to do this, and you know, the different teams within Baillie Gifford do this different ways. But the way that we are set up is that for the fund managers in the team, if they want to buy a stock, we will buy it. So there's not a democracy. We don't vote on it. It's not an autocracy. I don't, as the head of the team, have a veto. If one of the fund managers wants to buy a stock, we'll buy it. And for the analysts, they just need the backing of one of the fund managers. And the rationale for doing it that way, again, comes back to this underlying purpose of trying to find, you know, outliers. If that person who has the idea is right about it, then the payoff will be much greater than the money we'll save if they're wrong about it. So our bias is trying to get as many of these ideas into the portfolio as possible. But it also, and this is an area I find fascinating. The thing I value about it is it also changes completely the dynamics of how you might discuss that idea. So, you know, if the three of us were a decision-making group and I was bringing an idea that we were going to vote on, then my bias would be that I've got to sell you guys this idea. And I'm going to emphasize the positives in the investment case rather than, you know, give you a balanced view. And I'd be less inclined to acknowledge my misgivings. And that has a couple of consequences. You know, when as an investor, you know, when a company's going wrong for you, you know, deep down you know it. But one of the hardest things is to admit it to yourself. Now, again, it's having a process that doesn't reinforce those biases. So if I have sold the idea to you guys, it becomes that much harder. I don't now have to just admit that it's going wrong to myself. I have to admit that it's going wrong to you. Whereas when I brought the idea in the first place, I said, I'm really enthusiastic about this company. This is what I like, but these are my concerns. Let's explore them. You know, there's a much more balanced thing. And so if something goes wrong, I say, well, that was a concern and look, it's happened. So I stopped being a salesman for the idea and we can just genuinely explore the risks and the potential upside, because I know that if I'm enthusiastic about it, we're going to buy it no matter what you guys think. So we can have that conversation, I think.
Get in touch with us by email at schroederspodcasts@schroeders.com or visit our website, schroeders.com/investor download.
You touched on something there, which is really interesting, which we use quite a lot, which is that concept of a pre-mortem. So, you know, ahead of time, yes, I want to buy it. Let's talk about how we're optimistic, how I get 5 times my money, or how I make upside in our case. But let's also talk about the ways in which I might be wrong up front, so that we're admitting to the fact there are risks with this, that, you know, can we identify ahead of time and then it's easier for us to learn in the future. Is that something that's kind of baked into your process, and how does it feature and, you know, work when we get to the point where you think you have made a mistake and you do want to sell something from a portfolio? How does that part of the process work?
Yeah, sure. So some of my colleagues are fans of the pre-mortem process. We don't use it ourselves. But we do use something which is slightly analogous, which is trying to think through the, you know, what if this works? And the rationale is, you know, if your investment case comes to pass, you know, you have to update your thinking. Things have moved on. You can't have the same hypothesis anymore that you had about the company. So what are the challenges at that point? And in part, it's a sort of from past learning. You know, if I go to the last decade, one of the successful investments we had was Petrobras. Yeah, and they discovered, you know, it really worked. You know, they found all this oil in offshore Brazil. It became a much bigger company. But then, you know, the challenge as an investor was, you know, suddenly they had to basically mobilize a supply chain of about 1 million people in Brazil, which is not necessarily an easy place to mobilize that type of resource. You know, and you're operating in deep water as well. So, you know, brought all of these different challenges. And so, you know, we sold it and we made money, but could we have sold it better? You know, maybe if we'd thought more about the consequences of success upfront in the investment case.
So we discussed the pre-mortem there, but it was more around the idea of, so I can see some enormous strengths to having one person needs to be convinced and that's how an idea gets in. Obviously, you could end up in a situation with a very broad proliferation where you end up with a lot of ideas going in. But if you've got that distribution we talked about where there are some very big winners, that's fine. You just have to make sure you have those winners. But one of the, you know, as a fund manager myself, and I'm being very unkind here because I personally find it much harder to be asked questions about selling stocks than buying stocks. So I'm going to be rather mean to you, Tom, and ask you all about selling stocks. But, you know, either with winners where they do well, where it's hard to know, and we know from your process it's something where you've been very successful at running winners, or even worse, where it's something that actually is going wrong and you're not sure, you know, how do we get to that point where we say, you know, now I have conviction to sell it? You've made it easier to make sure there aren't the psychological barriers or the unconscious biases to make that impossible. But how do we get to the point where that happens mechanically, and who makes that call?
Yeah. So, I mean, the starting point for us, you know, you go back to what we mustn't do is truncate the impact of the big contributors, you know, that small handful of stocks that, you know, if you are trigger happy about selling them because they've gone up and therefore become in some way more risky, or you lose your nerve with them, you know, that the process has to be oriented around making sure you maximize the contribution of those outliers. And so, you know, does that potentially make us a bit slow to sell things? You know, yes. And it's quite deliberate. I think the follow on is if you have this structure whereby an individual bringing an idea, if they're enthusiastic about it, it'll get bought. What it tends to do is raise the bar for that individual. You know, because if I've done, you know, a month's work on a company and I'm quite interested, but I'm not quite sure, you know, I'm going to, if it's a democracy, I'm going to bring that to the group and I'm going to, you know, tell you about all this work I've done and be enthusiastic about it. And maybe I'll be allow myself to be talked out of actually investing in it. But, you know, we have that discussion. But if I know I'm bringing this idea and it's getting bored, you know, then I think my own personal filter starts to increase. And so, you know, what I found is that you don't get that proliferation of holdings. Instead, it's that people start bringing only their highest conviction ideas to the group. So it's quite, it moves the filter a stage further out.
That's interesting.
And then when it comes to selling, most of the time it's the purchases that drive the sales for us. I've owned Amazon for most of the past, well, certainly most of the past 15 years. But it's, you know, I don't own it because I've owned it for 15 years and, you know, we just shut our eyes to it and keep going. It's, and, you know, at any day you could sell it and buy something else. So, you know, what's important to me in terms of the sell discipline is ensuring that you have that pipeline of ideas coming through, that competition for capital. And, you know, that I will sell some Amazon if I think the risk adjusted return offered by something else is more compelling. And I think that's what keeps you honest and keeps you disciplined about the ones either that have achieved their potential and therefore the valuation, or where the investment case, you know, the hypothesis that you had has been undermined in some way. You know, and if your attention goes towards this next new idea rather than rewriting the hypothesis that you had for this company that hasn't worked, then I think it tells you something about your own beliefs.
I think it's really interesting to have this conversation. I'm struck about, you know, the holding size. There are so many things that actually, weirdly, for value and growth investors, we have in common. You know, the long-term holdings, the behavioral challenge of consensus, the benchmark, you know, unaware nature. But there are a couple of areas where we differ. And one you've just highlighted there, which was particularly around running winners and position sizes. Another area, I think, where we might be slightly different, and it's one where I've personally got, you know, I wax and wane about the importance of this, or not the importance of it, my ability to do it, is in the management meetings and the identifying of the mercurial geniuses and so on and so forth. Because I worry sometimes that there's a lot of hindsight that goes on in investing, but this is a classic area for hindsight where, you know, we all look back at a Jeff Bezos or an Elon Musk and say, God, they were geniuses, but the false positives are ignored. So, you know, there are many businesses that had people that were also seemingly very clever and mercurial, and, you know, they went on to be WeWorks and not Amazons. So can you talk a little bit about what you get out of management meetings, what you're looking to specifically try and get out of those meetings, and how you factor that into the decision-making process to buy?
Yeah. So I think I'd start by going back to one a couple of questions ago about talking about, what is it that facilitates long-term decision making in the business? You know, if you look at some of these decade or multi-decade growth stories, I think part of that has been driven by a willingness to invest in future opportunities and deliberately depress profits over the next 12, 18 months to invest in things that have a longer term payoff. And so, the starting point for me, I think, in assessing the management or the culture of a firm is, what is it about that company that facilitates that type of decision making? Are they prepared to announce that profits aren't what they're going to, aren't what they were hoping because they're investing in XYZ project and take the share price punishment that comes with that in the short term because it creates these opportunities? And then I think that we're really fortunate to be investing in a number of companies that are run by visionaries, run by geniuses. And we definitely are not those things. So actually just one of the advantages of the buy and hold strategy, I think, is that you get to spend time with these people. And if you aren't interested in this year's earnings or next year's earnings, and you don't want to talk about what the current metrics are, but actually you want to explore what their ideas are for the next 5 or 10 years, what they think is important, and actually just getting that opportunity to hear them talk about it and then feeding some of those ideas back into your own investment process, I think is a really valuable source of insights. Let's take an example. So Bezos at Amazon, we've all been, or at least we have been sort of thinking a lot about gaming over the past, let's say, 3-5 years, and the way that the business model of gaming is transitioning from buying these expensive video games and expensive hardware to an environment which is much more about an ongoing subscription business. It's about esports and watching people play video games and all of these sort of things. Now, we've got there in the past 3 or 5 years. Bezos at Amazon bought Twitch, 10 years ago, which is the dominant media asset in this area. He's been so far ahead of everybody else. So just actually trying to channel a bit of that vision into what you're doing and the areas that you go looking for growth, I think can be extremely valuable.
Tom, this has been a very interesting conversation. And now we'd like to ask you 2 questions that we ask of every guest on the podcast. The first one is, could you tell us about a book you are reading or have been reading that you have enjoyed particularly and why?
When I think about our investment process, one thing that's important to me is that we're away from the noise of markets. And to being in Edinburgh, our physical distance from financial centres was something of value. It allowed us to not get caught up in whatever the topic of the day was. And as we've been through lockdown and everybody's moved to online and Zoom, one thing that's been on my mind is that we get sucked towards a more rapid pace of work, that we are easily contactable, that we were having the same meetings as everybody else. Again, back to these sources of information. And so one thing that's been in my mind is how do you counter that? And so one of the things I've set up is book club. And for anybody who wants to join it, we will choose a book for the month, and we'll get to the end of the month and have a meeting and talk about it. And it's valuable because it's encouraging people to read. It's valuable because it's saying, don't do the things that if you can judge every task by both its importance and its priority, don't focus always on the things that are high priority. There are other things that are more important. And one of those things is think about different sources of information. So get away from this pace of Zoom life and go read a book. And so getting through this to answer the question, one of the ones that we've read recently was How Nature Works by Purbach. And I think it's really interesting because what it's talking about is self-organized criticality. So it's a characteristic of complex networks. And it looks to be a driving force in all sorts of systems, from evolution to earthquakes to traffic jams. And as a way of understanding complex systems, as a way of understanding that extreme outcomes are just a characteristic of the system, not something to be excluded when you're trying to do your analysis. I think it's a fascinating read.
It's definitely one to add to the list. I'll have to reorder my reading pile because it's invariably much bigger than can get read.
I think
book club is a wonderful idea, and the idea of having that, of carving out space to read and to consume information in that way, I think is so important. So that's a great shout.
It's sending the message that it's important. And then I think one of the other things is, you know, if you read a book but you don't talk about it with anybody, it's very easy for it to go in one ear and out the other. As for me, I do it through Audible rather than actually reading the physical book. But actually having that conversation about it and sharing the ideas with other people, I think helps consolidate it in your head.
I think that's totally right. I once had a friend who he got very bored with me reading books and then waxing lyrical about them because they had about 74 different things in them that were great. And he said, you know, if you could take 2%, 1% or 2% from every book you read in five years, you'd be a radically more happy, better, efficient person. So what is that one thing that you're taking from this book? And I always remember that at the end of the book, to just try and it's horrible to sum it up in such a short way, but what thing are you taking away? And it's a lovely kind of discipline, if you like. We also wanted to ask the other question that we always ask of all our guests on the pod is an example of a bad decision that either you've made or you've seen others make, where the outcome was due to what you think is a bad process rather than just bad luck.
One that's been on my mind recently is Atlassian. So this is a collaboration tool for software developers. And I knew it as a private company, I knew the management team, knew the approach, and looked at it at the IPO and decided not to buy it. And that IPO was December 2015. At the time, it was worth about $4 billion. Today it's worth $85 billion. So what's that, 15x? I don't know. And I was looking back at the meeting note, and starts with, there's a general admiration for the business model and the culture. You know, these things we really look for. And then we struggle to see how we make a lot of money from this starting point. So I think that, you know, again, it goes back to the sort of process. It's, you know, if you think there's something about the company and about its approach and about the potential, then you want to be less worried about the starting valuation. It may be that you just can't, your imagination just isn't good enough about what the potential upside is.
I think it's really interesting that it's, you know, we talked at the very start of the pod about loss aversion being very powerful with people, but you know, with the kind of stocks you're looking at, the loss is, you know, it's the opportunity cost that's been lost rather than the actual capital loss. And I think that's fascinating. It's been hugely enjoyable talking to you, Tom. Thank you very much for taking the time to come and speak to Vera and myself. We've enjoyed it, seeing the similarities, exploring some of the differences, and hopefully people who have listened will learn a lot. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to find out more, check out our website, schroders.com/theinvestor download.
You can also get in contact with us about anything in the show or ideas for future shows at schroederspodcast@schroeders.com. Please remember to subscribe to us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review. We're now doing one show a week, which will be available every Thursday from 5 p.m. UK time. Thanks very much for listening, but above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.